So a few things before we start. So first of all, happy birthday to Juan. Second, the video is because one of the students told me she would not be able to come, and since this is going to be a continuing sequence, it makes sense to take it. So it's for one individual student, but it will be on the class website. So all of you can use it, including all the others who didn't come today. Good. So the plan for today is, first of all, I want to finish the theory of Hovanov homology, and then I want to start with the implementation, and I probably will not get very far, but I'll get somewhere. Now, sort of usually on, what is it today, Wednesday? So usually on Wednesdays I try to also go a little bit on in the book, through the book. I got a bit disappointed, and I'm maybe after the break I'll come up with some alternative, but at the moment I don't want to do it. I want to just concentrate on Hovanov homology. There are two handouts to pick up over there. Okay, so let me remind you where we were. So very, very quickly, okay? There was the Jones polynomial defined by only three things. Overcrossings goes to a zero smoothing minus a one smoothing. Undercrossing goes to something similar. And a circle goes to, a cycle goes to Q plus Q inverse. And actually, maybe I want to say something about the four smoothings that appear here. So, notice that I've used directed strands here and unoriented, undirected strands on the right. So, this was necessary because after you make these changes, so for example, if you look at this smoothing, the one on the right, then it connects arrowhead to arrowhead. So it doesn't respect orientation. Okay? So that's one point. And the second point is that the dependence on the orientation in the left-hand side is also extremely mild. Namely, let me tell you, suppose there was no orientation on these strands. There would still be a way to distinguish between these two smoothings. Namely, let's start with the lower strand, say, let's call it strand 0, and the upper strand, let's call it strand 1, right? So I guess it's by the level, by the height. So the lower strand is strand 0, and the upper strand is strand right. And then this smoothing is you enter at 0 and you turn right at the crossing. And you do it no matter whether you enter from the bottom left or from the top right. Remember, I've removed the orientation from these smoothings. You know, maybe I should make it larger so that it will be clearer. So remember, I've removed the orientation. So basically, to get this smoothing, I enter at 0 and turn right at the intersection. Or I enter at 0 from the other side and turn right. And to get this one, I enter at 1 and turn right, or I enter at 1 and turn right. Okay? So I don't really need to know the orientation to separate these two. And the same rule holds for the case of an undercrossing. So in the case of, so people who just came to pick up handouts, but maybe later. Okay? So here also, the first smoothing is obtained by entering at 0 and turning right. And the second one, the other one, is obtained by entering at 1 and turning right. Hence, from this point on, I will call the first one the zero smoothing and the second one the one smoothing in both cases, okay? And the zero smoothing comes with the one smoothing comes with a coefficient which is one more, so one power of q more than the zero smoothing. Okay? So really I could have written it as a crossing, no matter how it is oriented, goes to its zero smoothing with coefficient 1 minus its 1 smoothing with coefficient q, and then the orientations only determine an overall coefficient which multiplies both factors. So that overall coefficient would be q for the positive crossings and negative q to the minus 2 for the negative crossings. Okay? So this is it's mostly a waste of time. I'm mostly telling you about combinatorial nonsense. Anyway, that's the Jones polynomial. And here is how you compute it in practice. Again, I'm reviewing. Okay? In practice, you have a n crossing knot. It leads to an n-dimensional cube of smoothings, because every crossing has two possibilities. I like to, so this cube is indexed by the binary numbers from 000 n zeros to 111 n ones. And I like to skewer this cube. You know what's to skewer, right? It's sort of what you do when you put stuff on a barbecue. So I like to skewer this cube along its main diagonal, so along the diagonal from 000 to 111, and put it on the grill and then project. So it looked like a layered thing where layer 0 is all vertices whose sum of coordinates is 0. Layer 1 is all vertices whose sum of coordinates is 1. Layer 2 is 110, 101, and 011, and so on. And of course, this generalizes to higher dimensions. Now, in each cube here, you get a, so in each box here, in each vertex, you have a binary number which indicates which smoothing it is. And also, which vertex of the cube it is, and then there is the actual smoothing, and then that smoothing turns into a polynomial, Laurent polynomial. So when I say polynomial today, it will always mean Laurent polynomial. So it will turn into a Laurent, it turns into a Laurent polynomial by looking at q plus q inverse raised to the number of cycles, and a prefactor which depends only on the sum of the coordinates and the types of the crossings. And you sum these polynomials in the vertical direction, you get the polynomials written on the top, and then you take the alternating sum of those, and that's the Jones polynomial. So I wanted to categorify this, and let me very quickly remind you, or am I wasting your time?
Not yet.
What? Not yet. Okay. So let me quickly remind you that sort of my rule is to try to replace Laurent polynomials by, or, you know, my kind of first rule is to try to replace positive integers by vector spaces whose dimension is that integers. If it's over integers of any kind, possibly negative, I try to replace them by complexes whose Euler characteristic is that integer. And if it's a Laurent polynomial, I simply have a separate complex for each coefficient. But it's more efficient to describe it as a Laurent polynomial is replaced, okay, if all the coefficients are, or if everything is positive, then it's replaced by a vector space whose, which is graded, which is described as a sum of vector spaces with sort of degrees. And for such a vector space, I define the Q dimension to be the generating function of the dimensions. And then if I want to categorify arbitrary Laurent polynomial, I turn them into complexes, so a chain of vector spaces with maps between them, such that the square of the map is equal to zero, so it's a complex, the degree of the map is equal to zero, so that essentially it's a direct sum of, in each degree you have, the different degrees do not interact, and such that the Euler character, the Q Euler characteristic, which is just the alternating sum of the Q dimensions, is the polynomial you're trying to categorify. And then, as I said last time, Euler's theorem still holds. Namely, the alternating sum of the dimensions of the chain spaces is equal to the alternating sum of the dimensions, Q dimensions, of the homologies. This is all a review, hopefully. And then I should have said, and then there are a number of operations. So the operations are on the level of vector spaces, you can take the degree shift, the direct sum, and the tensor product. So the degree shift becomes, as indicated here, so this is what degree shift means, and it becomes multiplication by q to the l. The direct sum becomes addition of polynomials, and the tensor product becomes product of polynomials. In other words, if you look at the Euler characteristic of a tensor product, it's the product of the, sorry, not the Euler characteristic, the q dimension of a tensor product, it becomes the q dimension of it becomes the product of the Q dimensions of each of the factors. Sorry.
Okay.
Okay, so this is still a review. Okay, and then Hovanov associates with a link L, a chain complex of graded Z modules. And this is the summary of the association, but I will explain it again on the picture a little bit better. And let me now explain it on the picture. So the idea is, or the point is, first of all, the key or the repeating thing that occurs here is Q plus Q inverse raised to some power. So instead of Q plus Q inverse, you find a vector space whose dimension is this. So V is the vector space generated by two vectors, V plus and V minus, such that the degree of V plus minus is plus or minus one. And then the quantum dimension, the Q dimension, sorry, is Q plus Q inverse. And then when you see Q plus Q inverse raised to the power 7, you replace it by V tensor to itself 7 times. And when you see Q plus Q inverse raised to the power 7 and multiplied by some prefactor Q to the minus 2, you replace it by V tensor with itself 7 times with all degrees shifted by minus 2. Okay? So you get a vector space in each of the squares here. So here it is V tensor with itself twice, because it's Q plus Q inverse squared, times, or since it's Q to the 5, it's shifted 5 times. Shifted by, degree shifted 5 times. Okay? Now, okay, so the theorems here are the following theorems. So degraded Euler characteristic of the complex, I haven't yet defined the complex, right? I've only defined vector spaces. But the point is that I will insert differentials, boundary maps, and then the graded Euler characteristic will be the Jones polynomial. But this theorem is already achieved, right? It doesn't matter what the differentials are, the graded Euler characteristic it can be computed just from the chains. You don't need to know the differentials. So theorem one is kind of tautological. It's been done. Okay? The second theorem is that the homology of the complex is a link invariant. Okay? This theorem I will not prove. Okay? Because, you know, this is not a class on homology, it's a class on computations. Theorem number three is that this homology is in fact a stronger invariant than merely the Euler characteristic. Right, the Euler characteristic is the alternating sum of the dimensions of the homology groups. So a priori, if you know the homology, you know the Jones polynomial, but you can't necessarily go backwards. And then theorem number three says that indeed you cannot go backwards. And the proof is simply by you exhibit two knots whose Jones polynomials are the same, but their Hovanov homologies are different. Okay? Now, how do you know that their Jones polynomials are the same? You fit them into the program from last class. How do you know that their Hovanov homologies are different? You fit them into the program that we will write now. Okay? Nothing exciting, okay? But you must have the program. So, in fact, Hovanov wrote his papers sometime in 99, and basically nobody looked at them until two or three years later when I wrote the programs, and it became clear that this is actually something new. Until the computations, you could have thought that this Hovanov homology is just an intricate way to recode the Jones polynomial. I mean, that there is actually a way to go back from the Euler characteristic to the homology.
Okay? Did he have theorem 2?
Oh, of course he had theorem 2. So Hovanov is responsible for 1 and 2. I'm only responsible for a computation, but sort of without the computation, it wouldn't have been interesting. You know, if you want another story, theorem 3, well, okay, you know what, never mind. I can tell you the date when it was proven, but maybe not now. So what did I want to say? Okay, so next, I want to complete the construction of the Hovanov complex. Okay? So by the way, this is a math talk right now. Okay? So not yet an implementation, but you must understand the math, otherwise we're implementing. So please stop me if... Okay. So... The idea is, so okay, for the chain spaces we will take the direct sums along the kind of layers of the cube. That's clear. For the differentials, we will put a map on every edge of the cube, and then simply take the sum of these maps as the differentials. Okay? So, in other words, right, so for example, if you have a sum, a direct sum of three vector spaces, these are graded vector spaces, but I don't need to say it every time. So every time I will say a vector space, I will mean graded vector space. And if you have a direct sum of three vector spaces, and you need a map into another direct sum of three vector spaces, then you really need to specify a matrix of maps. You need to specify how to map something from this component of this sum into each one of the components of the target sum. Okay? So basically, in order to describe a map from this layer to this layer, I need 9 maps. So a map from each one of these to each one of these. And then Khovanov's suggestion was to take maps along the edges of the cube, and all the edges that are not here are just zero, are the zero map. So in other words, you know, there is no edge from this vertex to this vertex, so the map from this direct summand to this direct summand is the zero map. Okay? Okay, so now I need to write a map on each edge. Okay, a linear transformation on each edge. Okay? And what do these linear transformations, what do they have to satisfy? So, two or three things. First of all, I need to know that the differential squared is equal to zero. Okay? So, I need to know that if I start from any box here and go two layers up, I get zero. But going from any place to any place two layers up, so I need to choose a box here and a box here, and then there are two ways to go from one box, from a box to a box two layers up. Namely, you can either go, in the picture it's obvious, you can either go up and then down, or down and then up. Generally speaking, if a vertex is two layers up from another one, then it means that it has two more bits that are turned on. And then you can turn on these two bits, so say these are I and J, then you can turn on these two bits in either one of two orders. Either first turn I on and then turn J on, or first turn J on and then turn I on. So this gives you two paths that lead to this other vertex. The sum of the map that you get here plus the map that you get here has to be zero. This is kind of ugly because it means that we need to construct a cube of maps. Well, it's three-dimensional here, but in general, n-dimensional, which is anti-commuting. Okay, so it should be a cube of maps such that around every face of the cube, the maps anti-commute. Okay, so that the sum of going on one side of the face or on the other side of the face is zero. Okay? Now, we're so used to commuting maps that constructing anti-commuting maps is painful. Okay? So, fortunately, there is a solution. Namely, here is a cube of signs. Or rather, it's a cube in which there is a sign marked on each edge. And my claim is that if you have a cube of commuting maps, and you multiply each map with the sign written on the corresponding edge, it becomes an anti-commuting cube, and vice versa. If you have an anti-commuting cube, and you multiply it by these signs, it becomes a commuting cube. Okay? So, what do we need to verify? We only need to know that around each face, there is an odd number of minus signs. Basically, that would be the difference, right? That would but make it. Okay? So, well, you can verify it by staring. So, around each face in this picture, there is an odd number of minus signs. So, around this face, there is just one minus sign. Around this face, there are three minus signs. And believe me that it goes on like that, yes.
So yeah, I think there's 1 to dx and then dx dz.
Sorry?
So you have 4 pluses on...
No.
The pluses...
Maybe you're not reading correctly which sign is associated with what. So which one? The 1 to dx dy?
No, the 1 to dx dz.
The 1 to dx dz plus minus...
Oh, sorry.
Plus plus.
Yeah, I've read the plus on it.
Yeah, okay, sorry. I mean, okay. Anyway, where do these kind of signs come from? So I think the picture more or less says it. Okay? So the n-dimensional cube is also in a bijection, or the vertices of the n-dimensional cube are also in a bijection with the generators of the exterior algebra. Dx1 up to dxn, right? Okay, and then on the exterior algebra, there are 3 operations.
Sorry, what's the statement of the exterior? What's the vector space?
Take an n-dimensional vector space. So this has nothing to do with V, this is a new vector space. You know, let's call it Rn, okay? So Rn is, even though, you know, I'm religiously against the real numbers, but that's a different story, okay? So let's call it, so this is symbolic to something else. Okay? So Rn is, generated by dx1 up to dxn. These are the basis elements. And then I'm looking at the exterior algebra of Rn. So the exterior algebra of Rn is, well, the collection of all things of the form, you know, dxi1 wedge up to dxik, right? And there are 2 to the k of them. Sorry, 2 to the n of them, and they are in bijection with sequences of zeros and ones, namely...
projectively, because they have a...
No. Oh, yeah. You have to choose signs, right.
And yes,
so choose, basically, the signs that you always take them in order, okay? So x always appears before y, and y always appears before z, and so on. And then the basis is fully determined, but now there are 3 operations. There is wedge with dx, wedge with dy, sorry, in general, n operations, namely exterior multiplication, so omega goes to omega wedge dxi. These are the n operations. These operations exactly raise or go up 1 along one of the edges. Okay? So looking at all the places where acting by these operations on one of the basis elements exactly corresponds to the edges of the cube, and each one gives you a sign, because you actually get either, you know, when you take dz and wedge it with when you take dz and go horizontally, so wedge it with dy, you either get dy wedge dz or dz wedge dy, and they differ by a sign. So each one gives you a sign. And then the fact that around each face you get an overall minus sign is the fact that if you take omega and you wedge it with dxi and then with dxj, you get the opposite of omega wedge dxj wedge dxi. So that's essentially the definition of an exterior algebra algorithm. Okay? That's where the signs come from. Okay? There is actually an easier way to write it. Okay? So let me denote the sign. Okay, let me use binary sequences, so sequences of zeros and ones, to denote the vertices of the cube, and then sequences of zeros and one with one star in them to denote the edges. So in other words, a sequence of the form 0, 1, 1, star, no, let's make it 1, 0, 1, 1, star, 0, 1, denotes an edge in the seven-dimensional cube, because there are seven stars here. And this is the edge going between the vertex in which star is replaced by 0, so 1, 0, 1, 1, 0, 0, 1, and the vertex in which the star is replaced by 1. So 1, 0, 1, 1, 1, 0, 1. Okay? So if you call this xi, then xi I will be the coordinates of this xi. And then I will define minus 1 to the xi. So minus 1 to the xi will be the sign associated with xi using this exterior algebra construction. And you can check that it's just the following thing. Basically, it's the parity, or minus 1 to the number of 1s that occur before the star. Okay? So, again, the number of 1s that occur before the star, so in our case it's 1, 2, 3 1s, so this is, in our case, minus 1 cubed, which I believe is minus 1. Okay? Now, you could use this to show that the signs that around the cube you have an overall minus sign. You could use it directly. You don't need the exterior algebra. Let's check it just for fun. So what would enumerate the faces of the cube? So each face of the cube corresponds to a string of zeros and ones with two stars in it, because two things can switch from 0 to 1. So basically you'll get things like 0, 1, 0, star, 1, 0, 0, 1, star, 1, 0. Okay? And then there will be two edges coming out of this vertex. The lower left vertex here will be when you replace the two things by zeros, and there will be two edges coming out of them. One with a... Well, okay, you know what? I'm wasting your time. It's too easy. Okay? Okay. I mean, I could implement it and verify it, but I think we'd better move on. The implementation will come within at some point. Okay? Okay. Okay, so now, all I need... So the moral is that all I need is to find a commuting cube. Okay? But next, let's look at what do I have to play with if I want to get a commuting cube. So the information along each edge is the following. So along each edge of the cube, you get a re-smoothing. So on the left, so basically some zero gets turned into a one, which amounts to saying that some smoothing is turned into its opposite. Okay? Now, but you see, each smoothing, or each kind of local smoothing, comes within a bigger context, right? So, and all the rest of the context does not change, because all the other vertices are fixed, or all the other crossings, the corresponding coordinates are fixed, so they remain the same smoothing. So basically, if you look from far away, either this connects to that and this connects to that on the left-hand side, or this connects to that and this connects to that. Right? Okay? And then after the resmoothing, this becomes the other way around. So it becomes this. And this one becomes, again, the other way around. So that. Okay? And here, kind of, a part of the picture is exact, so the center is exact, and the outside, I really mean this could be a complicated path that goes through half the knot, but it's the same before the resmoothing and after the resmoothing, okay? So in fact, I don't bother to indicate this potential complexity, I just write it as a path. Okay?
Caesar and what?
What?
It's a joke. I just remember the Caesar and what.
Okay. Anyway, now remember that each cycle corresponds to a factor of V, a tensor factor of V. V being the two-dimensional vector space, or the Q plus Q inverse dimensional vector space we talked about before. Okay? So, if you give me two maps, a map M going from V tensor V to V, and another map delta going from V to V tensor V, then I will be able to construct a cube. Okay? Consider, for example, this edge. In this edge, at the beginning of the edge, I have V tensor V. At the end of the edge, I have V tensor V three times. I need to construct a map from V tensor V to V tensor to V cubed, from V squared to V cubed. Okay? Now, one of the Vs, one of the things that correspond to a factor of V is untouched. Namely, this cycle here just becomes itself. So take the identity on this tensor factor, and then the other V splits into two copies of V, so tensor the identity map with the map delta from V to V tensor V. Okay? So basically, if you give me M and delta, I can construct a cube of maps. But this cube of maps needs to be commutative. So let's see what constraints on M and delta are imposed by the commutativity of the map, by the fact that I need a commutative cube. Okay. So here they are. Okay, so first of all, I actually lied to you, which is in my nature. I actually need a little bit more in order to construct the cube. Namely, consider, for example, an M map. Where do I have an M map, like going from here to here? Two cycles merge into one. There is no canonical way to order these two cycles. So I need a map from V tensor V to V, which is invariant under switching the first two tensor factors. Otherwise, I wouldn't know what to put on this edge. Okay? So my first condition is that V tensor V into V is symmetric. Okay? And likewise, when I take a V and split it in two, there is no canonical ordering of the two factors that appear here. So the map from V into V tensor V is also symmetric. So this is in a different sense. So this is if you flip in the domain, there is no change. And this is if you flip in the target, there is no change. Okay? Okay. Two, so to discuss the commutativity of squares, I just need to look at all possible squares that can arise, all types of squares or faces that can arise. So, here are the three types. There are three types, it turns out. So, you could have three cycles, which kind of are, or let me put it this way. You have two coordinates that switch from 0 to 1, right? On a face, you have two coordinates, or two stars, two coordinates that switch from 0 to 1, right? Now, these the ends of a name or what comes out of a neighborhood of those corresponding smoothings can reconnect this way or in three other ways. And let me or two other ways. And let me tell you what they are. So, you know, here if I re-smooth this, the picture becomes that. And if I re-smooth this, the picture becomes if I re-smooth the right, the picture becomes this. And now if I re-smooth the other one, the picture becomes this. And if I re-smooth the other one here, again the picture becomes this. So, I get a map from V tensor cubed into V tensor squared, and also here into V tensor squared, and here it's a single copy of V. And what are these maps? So, this copy of V is untouched, so it's the map 1, the identity, tensor M, right? I put together two copies of M, of V. So that's the identity tensor M. This map, well, the right component is untouched, so it's M tensor 1. This map is simply a map from V squared to V, and it's just M itself, and this is again a map from M, V squared tensor to itself, so this is M again. Okay? Now, so before writing the rest, let me interpret it. A map from V tensor V into V is simply a product. It's a bilinear product. It's what defines an algebra. Saying that it's symmetric means that it's a commutative product. Saying this is the meaning of being an associative product, right? Multiplying the first two factors and then multiplying the results is the same as multiplying the last two factors and then multiplying the result. So this condition is commutativity, and this condition is associativity. So the moral is, M defines a commutative associative algebra. In a similar way, delta, so I mean, here you may or may not have seen the notions before. Some of you have, some of you haven't. But delta defines a commutative associative co-algebra. So kind of the opposite of an algebra, or with the maps going the other way. It's in fact exactly the same, but with the maps going the other way. And then there is some compatibility condition between them. Class compatibility. And the compatibility, people who know things which are algebras and coalgebras will immediately jump and say that this must be a Hopf algebra or a bi-algebra, but in fact it's not. It's something else. It's a Frobenius algebra. It's a different type of thing with algebra and coalgebra. But in fact, we don't need it. Okay? We don't need it because you'll see in a minute that determining M and delta is trivial. Okay. Let me add one further thing. Remember that I want my differential to be of degree zero. Right? I want the overall differential to be not to raise degree and not to lower degree. Because I really wanted independent complex for each degree of the Jones polynomial. Independent complexes for each degree of the Jones polynomial. So, I want the overall D map from here to here, the overall differential, to be of degree zero. But, okay, when I told you that that I really need a map from V to V tensor squared, okay, or that I construct these differentials using these edge maps, using M and delta, I used the unshifted vector spaces. Okay? So, since wait, sorry. I'm confused now. So since the vector space that appears here is actually shifted by 4, and the vector space that appears here is actually shifted by 5, I need M and delta to have degree, now I'm confused, minus 1. I need M and delta to lower degree by 1, so that when you shift the degrees, it will be a degree, you'll get degree 0 maps. So the other condition, or the third type of condition, is M and delta must lower degrees by 1. Okay. This essentially fixes M and delta. Let me take one more picture. And then I'll tell you why it fixes M and delta. Okay, so what do I need to tell you? I need to tell you what M does to the following, M is a product. So I need to tell you what M does to V plus tensor V plus. I need to tell you what M does to V plus tensor V minus. I guess also to V minus tensor V plus, but M should be the same on both of these because it must be a commutative product. And finally, I need to tell you what M should do to V minus tensor V minus. Okay. On V plus tensor V plus, so this is something of degree 2. M should lower degree by 1, so the output should be something of degree 1. There is only one thing in degree 1, and that one thing is V plus. So n should map v plus tensor v plus to v plus with some coefficient here. Okay? Then m should map either one of these two, so these two are of degree zero. M should map them to something of degree minus one. There is only one thing of degree minus one, and this is v minus. So m must map either one of these to v minus with some coefficient which is still undetermined. Okay? And finally, v minus tensor v minus is of degree minus two. M should map it to something of degree minus three. There is nothing in degree minus three, so this must be zero. Likewise, delta. So delta should be defined only on v plus and v minus. On v plus, so v plus is of degree 1, applying delta to it should give you something of degree 0. Something of degree 0 in v tensor squared is either v plus tensor v minus or v minus tensor v plus. So you must get a combination of these two. Yes?
Sorry, I think I missed. Why would the v minus tensor v minus go to 0?
Because this is of degree negative 2. M must lower degree, okay. So you must get something of degree negative 3. But there is nothing in degree negative 3. Okay? So v plus must go to a v plus tensor v minus or v minus tensor v plus. Delta should be co-commutative. So, in other words, flipping the factors should give you the same thing. So these two things must come with the same coefficient, so it must be a multiple of their sum. Okay? And finally, v minus must go to, well, so v minus is of degree minus 1, it should go to something of degree minus 2. There is only one thing in degree minus 2, and this is a multiple of v minus tensor v minus. Okay? So this is all that there is. This is all that m and delta can be. I just need to figure out what are these 1, 2, 3, 4 factors. It turns out that by rescaling v plus and v minus, you can get rid of most of these factors. I don't remember what is what by now. And then the associativity condition determines the rest. And essentially, the most interesting solution, there is actually more than one solution, but the most interesting solution is all factors are one. So these are m and delta, as indicated on your handout. Namely, this is what m and delta do. Okay?
And at the end, the actual differentials in d0 1*, its definition depends on what's visible in the boxes?
Sorry? Yeah, so I think we're done. The complex is fully defined now.
And it's defined that depends on the knot. Like
on the knot, the complex.
And all its the reductions, its total load.
It depends on the smooth on the knot via its smoothings. What's the next after that? Oh, if it was more crossings, you would get a higher dimensional cube. And what did I want to say after that? Nothing. State the theorems. Yeah. So basically, everything is fully well defined, and we just have to compute. So maybe I'll go through it. You know, I have about 2 minutes until break. So let me wait. Ooh, there's a big difference between this clock and that clock. Sorry, I'm 6 minutes past break time. Nevertheless, let me go three. Is it okay?
Mm-hmm.
Let me go 3 minutes review, and then we'll take a break. Okay. So basically, given a knot, you construct a cube of smoothings. It's indexed by binary sequences. In between there is there are edges that are indexed by binary sequences with one star. Okay, and so like this would be star 01 because it goes from 001 to 101. Each edge has a sign on it, which comes either from the exterior algebra or from this explicit formula here. Each edge also has a map on it. The maps are, basically there are two types of edges. Edges in which two cycles merge, and edges on which a cycle splits in two. And then on the merge cycle, on the merge edges, you put M tensor 111, tensor 1s in the components that are not touched. In the split edges, in the edges in which there is a splitting, you put delta tensored by 1 as necessary. M and delta, okay, on each vertex, I should have said at the beginning, you put a vector space, which is a tensor power of a two-dimensional vector space. And M and delta are given explicitly on the generators as written here. And we've arranged things so that this would be a complex, namely d squared is equal to 0. And our challenge is to compute kernel modulo image for this complex, meaning homology. Okay? And I don't know what it looks to you. It should look very, very complicated. But, you know, it is complicated, but it does fit onto a one-page program. It's not that bad at the end. Okay? So let's take a 10-minute break until 2:18 and start with the implementation afterwards. Okay? Jonathan, can you turn off the camera?
Yes.